Go Off Track with RN.
Hello and welcome to Weekend Arts. I'm Jan Ryan, sitting in today for Sarah Konoski. Great to be with you. I've lots of surprises coming your way today, including a chat to the one and only Kamal about his beginnings in Adelaide and one very intriguing relationship. That's later this afternoon. In this hour, we'll be talking about arts festivals. Almost every city has one, yours might too, but who do you think they're really for? We'll also be heading inside some corporate art collections. How do organisations balance creativity with being corporate? And where does their interest really lie? Global curator of Deutsche Bank, which has one of the world's largest art collections, will be joining me to shed some light on this very interesting subject. And then I'll be taking you on a visit to a local corporate art collection. So stay with us now on Weekend Arts. It seems as though every major city in the world has its own arts festival. The recent history of the arts festival goes back to the post-war years when civic leaders began looking to the arts to animate cities and build civic pride. The Edinburgh Festival, perhaps the most famous of them all, began in 1947, and today's festivals are just too numerous to list. They're everywhere. But what are arts festivals really about, and whose interests do they serve? Shortly, we'll look at two small community music festivals that have grown up in rural Australia, but we're beginning on the global stage. Bernadette Quinn lectures in tourism at the Dublin Institute of Technology, and she joins us now on the phone, and she's written extensively on the meaning of arts festivals. How are you, Bernadette?
Good morning. Well, thank you, Jan.
Is the proliferation of the arts festival today simply one-upmanship, do you think, between major cities? Are they really just trying to outdo each other, basically?
Well, since the late 1980s into the 1990s, we have had a new instrumental use of culture, if you like, particularly among city governments, but also for use in regional development, where cities and regions trying to refine new ways, new modes of economic production for themselves in the wake of globalization and increasing competition, cities and regions have turned to culture and to the arts to try and find new means of competing with other places. And festivals fit within that general pattern, where cities and regions have developed festivals and events to try and attract not only tourists, but also to make their places better for residents to live in and more attractive for multinational corporations seeking to locate internationally. So it is definitely to be interpreted within the sense of competition between cities, yes.
If you just add culture and stir in an arts festival into the life of a city that's in economic decline, perhaps, to what extent can it really lead to changing the fortunes of that city to a urban regeneration?
I mean, I think that add culture and stir approach has been heavily critiqued in the last few decades, because it did seem at times that that's what cities were simply doing. Events now have the label festival attached to them, and sometimes one wonders, is it really a festival at all? It strikes me that festival just gets tagged on to so many things irrespective of what it is. What is a festival? I mean, a festival is about celebration.
Is it about money nowadays?
In the first instance, it's about celebration. And then certainly it has been used as something that can generate economic wealth. But, you know, that's not necessarily in and of itself a bad thing. Cities must find ways of generating wealth, and generation of wealth can be poured back into cities to make them better places to live. I suppose what matters is that the artistic activity that happens inside of that festival or event is valid and is useful and is meaningful to the people who engage with that festival.
I wonder how much the money influences the tensions between, say, civic leaders who want their city noticed and branded and to be proud of it, and then there's the artists, the people who are sort of generating the creative energy. Is the money agitating that kind of division in communities?
Things can go horribly wrong. I mean, if an economic imperative is driving a festival such that, you know, all it's trying to do is attract, say, outsiders who might spend money in a place, then I think it's not going to last very long. So if there are tensions, you know, we mustn't deny the agency or the ability of the artists and the artist directors to program as they wish and to experiment, which, of course, experimentation and newness and innovation, they're the core to the idea of the festival. The thing about festivals is that they offer something different. They ask people maybe to think and act in a slightly different way. I mean, the Dublin Fringe is on at the moment, and, you know, different kinds of acts experimenting in different kinds of ways, putting different art forms together in forms that perhaps we're not used to seeing are what are filling a whole host of venues, regular venues and tiny off-the-wall venues. I mean, that's another thing. Festivals bring people into parts of their towns and cities that perhaps they wouldn't normally be. They encourage us to think about the spaces of our city in different ways, and they encourage us to become familiar with parts of cities that we perhaps wouldn't for you know otherwise go. So festivals challenge, they open up, they have a sense of newness. And for those reasons, they're quite different, I think, to the regular offering.
I think you're right. It's a very different experience of the city and of the architecture as well as the arts of a city. Mm. Bernadette Quinn, thank you so much for joining Weekend Arts today.
You're very welcome.
Bernadette Quinn lectures in tourism at the Dublin Institute of Technology. I want to zero in now on two relatively small Australian festivals, and we've chosen two with a lot in common: the annual Bangalore Music Festival and Bermagui's biennial Four Winds Festival. They're both classical music festivals at either end of New South Wales. So in a sense, while catering for their local rural communities, they're also competing for a wider audience of music lovers looking for a weekend in the country, perhaps. The Bangalore Festival is now in its 13th year. It involves an audience of a couple of hundred in a beautiful old timber community hall, while around 2,000 can attend the Four Winds Festival, which since the early 90s has been staging music performances in an idyllic outdoor location on a property just outside of Bermagui in southern New South Wales. So what can we learn from their experience about the worth to the local community of festivals such as these? Paul Dean was a founding artistic director of the Bangalore Music Festival and now heads up the Australian National Academy of Music. And welcome, Paul.
Good morning.
Sheena Baljan is a Bermagui local and chair of the Four Winds Festival, although she's currently in New York, where she joins me on the line today. Hi, Sheena.
Good to be with you.
Sheena, now, rightly or wrongly, the idea of classical music has always had an elitist image. How do you shake that off in a small fishing township like Bermagui and make it meaningful and accessible to everyone, including the locals?
Yeah, fabulous question to launch us into this discussion. Thank you. We actually learnt a lot about the potential for that to become a problem. Our festival site is a bit out of town and not visible from the main road. So after doing our first probably 10 festivals, it was very clear to us we had to ask ourselves and what are we doing this for and what does the festival really stand for. So we did a couple of things. First of all, we brought the festival into town, and on the Easter Friday we do a free community event on the Oval which includes some of the weekend artists, but particularly focused on showcasing some of the local existing musicians, community choirs, theatre groups. So it was genuinely a display of who we are, as well as showing the brilliance and the quality of the musicians we bring in. And secondly, we asked ourselves, what do we need to do between the festivals so that our people and our community, of which we're all part of, say this is the value of the music and the celebration of a festival. So we do work with our local music educators and the young kids. And again, we use the same model of bringing in outstanding musicians and pedagogues from elsewhere to work with them. So those couple of things were sort of a launching pad for us to really try and be more thoughtful about how do we do things with our community and not impose them just on them.
Paul, you're also in New South Wales, the Bangalow Music Festival, up just in the north near Byron Bay, just near the border. But you're not run by a group of New South Wales people. You're actually from Brisbane. Then you bring in the Brisbane-based Southern Cross soloists. So what made you think that Bangalow could benefit from a festival, and how did you convince the locals?
Oh, yeah, look, they're also really good questions. I guess Southern Cross was at a point where a chamber music group based on wind instruments, piano and soprano in Brisbane was struggling to sort of get traction enough to be noticed by the funding authorities and et cetera, and large-scale private support. So we decided we were going to diversify, and so we started a number of educational projects throughout regional Queensland, which actually, in essence, changed my life personally, and that's why I guess I'm now running the Australian National Academy of Music here in Melbourne. Mm. But we were looking for a, you know, a festival. I mean, festival was the buzzword. If it isn't still today, it was, certainly was the buzzword around the turn of the century. And we were looking for more things to do, I guess, is the easy answer to that. And Southern Cross decided to put together a festival, and we found a venue for it, essentially 2 hours drive south of Brisbane. Something that was out of Queensland was actually good for us, I think, in many ways, because it started to increase the range of our audience. So I guess from a selfish perspective, we started the festival purely and simply because we wanted to. Mm. And it's funny that Sheena should say that after 10 years, they sort of sat back and looked and thought, oh, who are we and what the hell are we doing? That happened probably after about the third or fourth festival for us, when we started to really react and be much more a part of the community in terms of putting schools concerts on and a community concert on the night before the festival starts, which originally was just, you know, us showing off the various artists that were coming to the festival to the local community, who essentially spent the weekend looking after the people who were coming into the town. Mm. But that concert has now become a showcase for the local talents, like the Lismore Symphony Orchestra and Scarlet Affection, a local folk duo in the town, and various, you know, different children groups. So it's very similar to the way Sheena's describing the fact that, you know, it started as just this idea of running a whole stack of concerts in a beautiful setting, and it's turned into something that has become part of the local community. In answer to your question about how did we convince the local community? They welcomed us with open arms, because it was another thing that they could add to their calendar, and particularly being in winter in regional Australia, they were looking for a reason for why a couple of hundred people would come and visit for the weekend, I think. Mm. It's become, of course, a lot more sincere and deep than just making money, of course, these days.
Paul, one of the magic elements you haven't mentioned is the Wonderlic tin-lined hall. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
The ANI hall in Bangalow, the Agricultural and Industry Hall, which was designed basically as an exhibition hall for local produce way back in the early 20th century. We were looking for a hall to put this, and a town, I guess you could say, to put this festival on, and we happened to know somebody in Bangalow, and they organised for us to go and have a visit. I got my clarinet out in the hall and I played three notes and I went, this is it.
It's a beautiful sound, was it? Just like,
yeah,
perfect.
But the interesting thing, of course, is the hall was running down, and somebody recently told me that it was actually earmarked for demolition. It's now, of course, renovated. It's got change rooms out the back. They've spent a lot of money on the hall, and it has a year-round calendar. So I think, if nothing else, the Bangalow Festival saved what is a fabulous hall.
Sheena, you've got a venue, but it's a little bit different to that. It's something that you've had to build, and you've used well-known architect like Clinton Murray and Philip Cox. How did you get about to build a venue? Can you describe what you've got?
It is interesting why it happened, because Bermagui is best known as a fishing village of about 1,500 people. And we're surrounded by change. It's changing forestry and fishing and farming. And what we realised was that we didn't want to be seen as ambitious, bringing in all these wonderful national and international musicians. But sort of the so what question kept on coming up again and again. So we decided that we wanted to really have a permanent sound shell, and we wanted to be able to say, in our area, this richness of the art, particularly through the language of music, matters for the future of who we are and building a resilient place and resilient community. So Philip Cox generously said, look, I'd like to do the design for you. And it really did take a lot of courage for the board to say, is it right to raise money in a quite a low-income community to spend? So we've actually raised just under $3.5 million now to build a permanent cultural facility on the site, which is Philip's sound shell launched last year, and now Clinton Murray's pavilion, which is going to be an exquisite small performance space for residencies and workshops. And offices and so on.
Like a lot of rural Australian towns, Bermagui has had a pretty rough time. It's difficult out there making money. You've said in the past that you've been shocked by a lack of confidence amongst your fellow citizens. Now, I wonder what you meant by that and how you think Four Winds might have helped.
Yeah, I did say that. When I moved to the area, my husband changed professions from medicine to dairy farming, which is a bit of an unusual leap.
Yes.
And I was working as a consultant in the environment movement globally, and I was so shocked by how clever these farmers were, but so feeling that the world did things to them. Mm. And that when we were deregulated as a dairy industry, that you couldn't necessarily fight back. What was the point? And yet I felt that as individuals, they were so strong and brave and clever. And I felt that, just personally, I felt so much that we had to provide a model of aspiration, not desperation, through everything we did at Four Winds. And as an educator, I just felt so strongly that if we didn't help through our activities move beyond music as an event, if we didn't see it as an emotional opportunity to build confidence and build aspiration, we didn't add to all the work that the local musicians and other artists were doing in the community. Mm-hmm. So we saw very much that we had a role as a facilitator, not just doing things. And that role of facilitating and linking together other things that happened there and telling that story has become such a strong part of I think our message about the role of music in transforming and building strong communities for the future. And it's not just about the impact of economics and, it's not all that. It's much more about the magic and the emotion.
Mm. If you want to write a blueprint of how festivals should work, you just heard it then.
Just to pick up on the local stuff, because it's so profound, actually, I think, just to shift the confidence of people. Sheena, you've said that you want locals to feel comfortable, and by locals, they're very educated locals as well. I mean, it's not like locals are dumb and everyone else isn't. I just, hate that divide. But you want people who haven't experienced perhaps learning music, or someone who's just had just the opportunity in a small town and not outside of the town, which, you're bringing back. So you want people, say, who work in the local butcher shop to be able to go and feel the music and learn from it without knowing who Shostakovich is, for example. Is that...
Well, that's the thing. That exactly right. And Anam, with this partnership we've got with Anam, we had the Auric Quartet up in residence for the first time, and they wanted to do house concerts to rehearse new works for the Asia Pacific Chamber Comp they were doing. So we deliberately invited people who'd never been to Four Winds to come to these little house concerts. And they were so significant that one of the women said afterwards, "I feel as if I've been deprived all my life after listening to the music." And to us, that is what success is for us. And I was saying to somebody just today in New York who I'm meeting with that if we have 40% of our audience are locals. If that doesn't stay the same or increase, then we're not doing what matters to us as an organisation of Four Winds. That's the depth of the engagement we want.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Weekend Arts. Thank you, Sheena Balgin. She's the chair of the Four Winds Festival in Bermagui, and also Paul Dean, who now heads up the Australian National Academy of Music, but was our founding artistic director of the Bangalore Music Festival. Thank you so much to both of you today.
Great pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for discussing it.
And links to both Bangalore and Bermagui festivals on our website. You're with Weekend Arts on RN. I'm Jan Ryan.